You're listening to DevOps Radio, the podcast series that dives into what it takes to successfully develop, deliver, and deploy software in today's ever-changing business environment. This show is sponsored by CloudBees, the enterprise Jenkins company and continuous delivery leader.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of DevOps Radio. We've got a very special program for you today, live from DevOps World Jenkins World 2019. I'm joined by a few of my favorite people. We just finished a live panel here talking about upskilling, and we're going to go through some of the things that we talked about. I'm going to start with Jane. Jane, can you introduce yourself to the folks?
Sure. So I'm Jane Grohl. I'm CEO of the DevOps Institute. We're an open member community, so I hope everyone listening will join at www.devopsinstitute.com. We also are the founders of the Upskilling Enterprise DevOps survey and report, the first of which was published this past February, and hopefully we'll be able to share some of the data from that while we're talking to everybody today.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us. To your right is Damon. Damon Edwards, introduce yourself to the folks.
Yeah, hi. I'm Damon Edwards. I'm a co-founder of a company called Rundeck. We do runbook automation for incident management, so making incidents shorter and protecting team capacity. But I know that's not why I'm here today. I think it's my previous life experience as running DTO Solutions as the managing partner there. We did a lot of DevOps and IT process improvement for large enterprises. We're like the go-to kind of organization for taking the high-flying early DevOps ideas and porting them into large enterprises. So a lot of experience trying to get the human beings figured out.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us. Sean Davis.
Hey, so I'm Sean Davis. I'm Chief Transformation Evangelist for Equifax. I'm also a DevOps Institute instructor in several of our areas, most prominently in DevSecOps. Have some pretty heavy background in working with a lot of Fortune 1000 and 500 companies around business transformations, technical transformations, and digital transformations, moving to the cloud, changing the company's culture.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here. And Helen Beal.
Thank you. I'm Helen Beal. I am a DevOpsologist at Ranger 4, where I help my clients in Europe and the Middle East improve their organizational performance using DevOps principles and practices. And I am also a product owner at DevOps Institute for Jane.
Lovely. All right. So I think to get the conversation started, it doesn't take much more than looking at some of the news that's been in the media recently about some of the investments that companies are making in upskilling their people. I mean, Jane, do you want to talk a little bit about the Amazon investment?
Sure. So recently, Amazon announced a $700 million investment in upskilling, and they actually named their program Upskilling 2025. Now, that's really gratifying. Well, first of all, it validates some of the data we saw in the report last year, where the predominant hiring was from within. So organizations would prefer to upskill existing staff. And certainly Amazon is putting a large investment behind that. But it also demonstrates that one of the reasons upskilling is so important is there's a huge talent gap right now. There's a huge need for new talent, cross-talent, multi-talented people. And so part of the goal is met by really investing, right? Putting your money where your mouth is, investing in helping existing employees really start to groom new skills in order to meet new demands and therefore be able to improve the competitive landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a pretty interesting thread going on Twitter about internships, whether they should be paid or unpaid. And so you talk about how do you bring that next generation of folks forward and how do you help them get that knowledge. I think there's one reason why, and I'm glad to hear it, one reason why people want to train their existing people is the existing people have a lot of institutional knowledge. They have a lot of ideas around what's happening and they have the context.
You know, I make a point about the Amazon thing. It's interesting is that I feel like training budgets have never been the problem. Mm-hmm. A little helpful tip for anybody who wants to be a consultant, package whatever you do as a training and the budget is unlimited.
Interesting.
Because it's never spent. It's unlimited. Okay, unlimited is exaggeration, but the budget's always the budget's always there, right?
Right?
You know, oh, 50 grand here, 100 grand there. They're just sitting there in these training budgets that never get used. So it was always a great way to get things into organizations. And I think the issue is that's great.
This is a training coffee machine.
Yeah, it only helps everything more the consulting side. But it's an issue of where the budgets are there, but it's always kind of a middle management problem. I don't mean it's a problem with middle managers. I mean it's a problem with the pressures and the system that they're dealt with. It's like, okay, great. Now I'm going to take my team. I'm just going to send them for training. Training for what? You know, like they all want to go to Kubernetes training. We're not using Kubernetes. That's weird, right? Mm-hmm. So you pick up this, oh, they're going to go waste their time, mm-hmm. right? Which is one. Or like, why am I training my people to go get their next job, right? And right. then the other one is, okay, well, they need skills for this particular project. Well, we're not going to take a project budget and stop and have them go learn these skills. We got to now bring in external consultants to go, you know, to import the skills and, you know, keep my people busy with something else, and maybe they'll learn by magic, you know, osmosis. So I feel like the problem has never really been the money. The problem has been more of a structural and kind of organizational dynamics and incentives is always been the blocker to, you know, organizations training, upskilling, whatever you want to call it.
Right. And we had the conversation just a little while ago where we were talking about, you mentioned this sort of investment that people are making and that they're willing to make. And you made yourself a little vulnerable on stage earlier, and you talked about a decision that you'd made many years ago, not that many because you're not that old, but many years ago that you wish you could have done differently. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So true confession time, I did on the stage, so I'll purge myself even longer. So when I was an IT director, which admittedly is a while ago, it was a time where MCSC was a very coveted certification, and I ran an ops team. And so I couldn't send them all to class, right? I couldn't take them, you know, off the bench and send them all to class. So I purchased 20 online licenses for MCSC training, which, by the way, was pretty expensive, mm-hmm. right? And so I offered it them as an opportunity. It was my gift to them that if they were to, you know, go through this program, that they would then become MCSEs and presumably be eligible for promotion, grow their careers, and whatever. The mistake I made, and I think a lot of organizations even today make, is that, well, I gifted it to them. I didn't give them the time. Mm. Right? I didn't say, hey, everybody rotate 2 hours. Go lock yourself in a conference room and spend some time doing this. The assumption was that they would do it on their own time. They would do it at nights. They would do it on weekends because I had already invested this money. I wasn't going, hey, you have work to do during the wet day. What do you think? You're going to go sit in a room and learn? No. And, you know, reflecting back on that, that was a huge mistake because, you know, as I shared on stage, I bought 20, pretty expensive, only one person finished. Mm. Right. So I expected them to be excited and passionate and, you know, motivated to give up their family life, their personal life, their drinking life, their sleeping life in order to be able to do this accomplishment. And that was pretty naive. And it was also pretty selfish because I really didn't give them the time to learn. So, again, a long time ago, lesson learned. But if anyone's listening to this and you're kind of thinking the same thing, you're thinking wrong.
Mm. Interesting.
That's an example of cultural debt, isn't it? Basically, I mean, a lot of organizations owe a lot in cultural and technical debt. And it's kind of in contention with, I think, the pattern that we're trying to encourage in these new ways of working in terms of organizations being dynamic learning organizations where every individual feels empowered to learn. And that comes from the leadership and is all across the organization.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, cultural debt and technical debt kind of get a bad rap, too, because everyone talks about them like they're the dirty word behind the closed doors and we can't have any. But it's healthy to have some cultural debt. Where it becomes unhealthy is when we choose not to pay that back. You know, we can't go hiring people and say, hey, we want guys with the right mindsets and they're willing to be able to learn stuff and then we'll train everything else. And then you know what happens. They get to work. We throw them in the fire. 6 months later, they've still not been stopped to actually fill that gap we made the commitment for. They get burnt out. They leave the company and they tell everyone about this bad experience. And then everyone else in the company sees it and they're like, oh, not a big deal. This is just the way it always happens. And this is the way it'll always happen, right? And it ends up hurting our culture across the entire organization now, not just in this one specific instance.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, I just want to add something about the Amazon thing because I think it was really interesting. Notice the project is an upskilling 2020. Right?
Yes.
It's upskilling 2025. Mm. So there's a couple of interesting things to observe about that. First of all, upskilling takes time. right? So you can send somebody to a two-day class. They will come out with good practices, but they won't be practiced, right?
Yes.
So
right.
We have to recognize that upskilling is something that requires some time, opportunity to practice, opportunity to fail, opportunities to experiment, opportunities to learn. The other thing is, while we use the term upskilling, and you know, our report is the upskilling report, it really means right skilling, right? Mm-hmm. It means that in this broad base of skills, what are the right skills for you, for your personal goals, for your organization, and moving forward from that? And I think that when we start to look at these skilling programs, and more of those are becoming, you know, are being published at least. I don't know what's sitting behind the scenes, but they're being published, is that hopefully they're looking at it as right skilling, for, you know, the right skills for the right person. And of course that also means that on an innovation level, if I'm passionate about something, you know, I may want to become comb shaped instead of T shaped, which means I have multiple areas
Absolutely.
Of depth.
Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about what a T-shaped person versus an I-shaped person is for the folks who are listening?
Sure. I don't want to hog the conversation too much, though. That,
well, so, maybe someone else could talk about it. Helen, you probably
want to talk about T-shaped?
Yes, so I'll talk IT pie comb, if you like. So I is I'm a developer, for example. T is I'm a developer, and that's the I. And then you've got a bar that runs across, which makes your capital T. And that bar at the top would be a broad generalist, for example. Then you've got pie, which isn't a thing that you would eat. It's the Greek letter pi, so imagine a T now with two legs, if you like. And that might say, I'm a dev person and a tester, and I've got broad specialist knowledge. Mm. And the combs is the kind of the comb that you comb your hair with. So imagine that, loads of teeth. And you might say, I've got dev skills, I've got test skills, I've got security skills, sysadmin skills, I've got a bunch of skills. And linking them all together is broad business knowledge.
Is that a full
also,
stack engineer?
Also known, as a unicorn.
A unicorn. Yeah. Do those exist? And that's another question that we were going to get into is, does a full stack engineer exist?
Well, it's interesting. No. You know, one of the biggest misconceptions about the T-shape idea is similar to what's the misconception about the, you know, cross-functional team idea, that everybody must be the expert in everything,
Absolutely.
Right? Or that, oh, I can never be a T-shape because they think of more like a block, right? Like I know everything about everything. And I think you see in organizations that there's a high demand for owning a specialty, for saying, this is what I do. This is my thing that I hang my hat on. But you need to be able to build that understanding of how the rest of the world works around you, because nothing lives in isolation.
Right.
So you need to be enough to work within those systems, and then enough to have the same, you know, kind of impactful conversations with the other specialists in those areas.
I think there's a couple of other considerations kind of around this conversation. One is, what are the outcomes we're looking for? And one is the definition of done is not I did my job, but the customer received value.
Mm-hmm.
The other desired outcome really is about not having any kind of friction or delay in our team. So if one day there is more tasks that need to happen that are test related, there is an opportunity for a person in that cross-functional team perhaps to do a bit of the test automation scripts if they're normally a developer, and move around a little bit like that. And then I think the other thing we talked about earlier on is that, and I know we're talking about skills and culture and people, but actually there is an opportunity to talk about automation here, because the tools allow us to perform different roles in a way that we haven't been able to before.
Yeah, and I think the tools become the conversation piece. Mm-hmm. It's easier to talk about configuration and code than it is to talk about sort of general ideas where you don't know.
Squishy.
I can't see the mental model in your head. You can't see the mental model in my head. So it's a little becomes, you know, it's harder to build understanding in that regard. But if I put it down into code, and code could be a YAML file, right? It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be actual
in some way.
Executable code, right? It's just something that I could treat through a software development lifecycle. Mm-hmm. I can version it. I can, you know, have a build process, I guess, that puts it together. I can distribute it to people. But if we can talk about the automation, it does help that conversation. So there's a side benefit to, other than just being something that's automated, mm-hmm. but it's also now we can all collaborate on that definition,
right.
And we know what we're talking about, and we can pass it around, and I can know as if that's part of my T and not part of my stem or I or whatever it is, that I can read that, and if I know how all that works, now I can have a good conversation with you about that. And, you know, you might know all the intricate details of everything that could possibly happen there, and have thought out all the different permutations, but we can now have a conversation about, okay, how do we evolve this code? How do we get it to do what we need it to do? And it's, I think, useful for facilitating these conversations.
Right. It gives you something to hang on to, some context for you to be able to have that conversation with, because it's codified, as
especially in big distributed organizations now.
Right.
Can we all agree that, you know, one of the prerequisites for, you know, exceptional efforts of skilling should probably start with having that common language, right?
Absolutely. Like,
you made a really good point where you said, hey, you don't see the same mental model that I do, but
right.
if we're both speaking the same language when we say agile, when we say DevOps, what does that mean to us, and we're both on the same page about it, it's much more effective to get value out of the effort than it is when you expected something totally different.
So as everyone sitting here knows, DevOps Institute just recently introduced a series called Continuous Learning Minutes, and I think everybody here has contributed to that. And it's really like a video glossary with context, right? And it's just for that purpose, that if you hear a term or a concept or you're having a conversation with something, you know, language is the enabler and it's also the constraint. So if I, and natural language versus tech language. If I'm talking to you and I say something but you don't understand what I mean, I'm going to shake my head appropriately, but I'm not necessarily.
It compiles, but it's not going to make it through the test cycle.
And
right?
But again, I'm going to not, but I'm not going to contribute to the conversation. In fact, I may become intimidated by it, right? Mm. So it doesn't encourage a better level of collaboration. So continuous learning minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, in Damon's case, 5 minutes, as he confessed. Two or three minutes on different topics, really by thought leaders explaining what something is and why it matters. Right, so we had one done here yesterday about Spinnaker, right? Which a lot of people don't know what Spinnaker is. I didn't know really. I knew the term, but I really didn't know anything more about it. We've had Toil, we've had
Cerebs,
we've had ChatOps, we've had cultural debt, and so it spans a really wide range of topics. Very benign, very comfortable. So if you hear something and you're not familiar with it, go listen to a continuous learning minute for a couple of minutes and then go back to the conversation,
nice.
Right, and reach out to that person. So hopefully that, and you're right, we have to have a common vocabulary. So that's very, very critical. I also think, and to speak to Helen's point about the different, you know, pie shape, comb shape, right, broom shape, they call it. I think what's really, really important is when we start to look at value stream mapping, for example, as an exercise. The interesting thing about value stream mapping is not the amount of time it takes to do an activity, it's the amount of time between an activity. So the more that we enable people to do a certain level of something testing, right? So I'm a developer, I can do a certain amount of testing. I'm not an expert tester, I'm not an overachiever, I'm not necessarily going to become an expert at it, but it may reduce some of the wait time, right? It may give a faster flow because I have now enabled myself to do something that maybe previously I needed somebody else to do for me. So it is an empowerment of sorts, but with empowerment, it also means that you have to take the first step, right? You know, people upskill.
Right.
I can't upskill you, you can't upskill me, people upskill.
So Sean, talk a little bit about the program that you guys put in place at Equifax and how you, the success that you were seeing with people who were offered training and what you did to help increase that level of success.
Oh, absolutely. So one of the really interesting experiments that we had that kind of prefaced some of the stuff we talked about in the panel was when I first came in, we had bought all of these licenses and signed a multi-year contract with a vendor to be able to provide training because everyone says, hey, we want video training, right? That's how we best learn. So we took that feedback, went and found a best-in-class vendor, made a partnership. Well, 4 months prior to me arriving, we had been setting up all these programs, worried about cohorts, drawing up a ton of documentation, creating all of this collateral, and we'd only gotten about 250 licenses out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came in, I said, hey, you know, one of the things I found that's been very successful in cultures is you want to get it into the hands of the user as quickly as possible. I mean, that's really what DevOps, DevSecOps, and a lot of these things we're talking about result in is how quickly can we get value into the hands of our end users. And I said, let's try an experiment where we just automate anybody being able to get a license, but we wrap some requirements around it to hold some accountability. So when you sign up, you know the rules of engagement. You don't just arbitrarily ask for it, stuff it in a drawer somewhere, and then never use it, and value is lost. And Jane's example of the certifications. So the immediate next 6 weeks, And keep in mind, 4 months it took us to roll out 256 licenses.
We only are those 256 people who had finished something or just people?
No,
who had
200, the out of that, only 11% actually finished any type of course that they engaged in. Mm-hmm. And I think we only had three people that were showing certification at the time because we were just getting our certification program started. Within the next 6 weeks, we only had 1,000 licenses. We blew through it in 4.5 weeks, and there were no more licenses left. And we had just a ridiculous amount of people coming to us saying, hey, we wanted more. So we ended up buying more. And we found that with that rule set of engagement, that we were too worried about the documentation and all of the other things that came around it, that just getting it into the user's hands, we got much more rapid feedback from them about, here's what we like about the program, here's what we don't like. And now we know where to target specific content, where the gaps are in the training programs. Whereas if we would have make sure it's all in a pretty document, make sure it's well socialized and everything else, we wouldn't have figured this out for over a year.
But you also put some compelling events around the acquisition of that license to use that content.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we had things like when we send out your license, if you request a license, you have 7 days to respond to that. If you don't, your name goes to the bottom of the request list and everyone else has a slot before you. If when you engage in a course, once you have your license, you have 14 days to engage in your first course. If you don't, bottom of the list. If you start a course for certification or a practitioner license or whatever, solutions architect, you have 90 days to be able to complete it and then go test out on the certification. You don't have to obtain the certification, but you must finish that education. And it's like 7 to 12 hours worth of training. Mm-hmm. Not very difficult. Or you lose your license and you get rolled to the bottom of the list. So it holds accountability for people. And we saw our user stats shoot through the roof. I think it was somewhere in the range of like 87% of the people who engaged in the platform completed their courses. It was, you know, you saw the little bar chart, and then all of a sudden when we allowed people to just have carte blanche access to ask for it, it was like this much, this
so
difference compared
let me,
to...
Let me put a hypothesis crazy. Out there. Would it be the reason why people weren't doing it before is because they had work that they had to get done, and there was no mandate from anybody in management, no policy that said, I have to take this training. It was just the idea of, I'm going to sign up for training and I'd like to take it, but I still have all this other work I need to do.
So I think it was threefold or twofold. First was the access to how quickly they could get the license, right? Because you have to go through a request process and that adds cycle time to be able to activate. The second was that we found that users, they like to obtain something and then save it for when it's convenient for them. Because mm-hmm. some teams in our organization, they have innovation hours that are budgeted specifically for them team. And some teams have more than others. There are a few teams that are on critical projects that are still kind of moving into the culture that don't have that luxury yet, but we're working with them to get there. But we've got to get products out the door, right? We still have to generate revenue. And then the final one was... people didn't know what they needed, right? We're saying, hey, we're going to go all in on Google Cloud, and we're 100% in on this, and we're building products today natively in it, but no one's ever done anything in Google Cloud, so they don't know what services are out there. They don't know what they need to be educated on, and you just can't throw a catalog of 40 courses at somebody that says, here's Google Cloud.
Go figure it out.
And, you know, and then they're like, oh, well, am I supposed to start with storage? Am I supposed to start with data? Am I supposed to start with compute? So we had to wrap some training around that, and we were focused too much on like cohorts. Like, how do we group people together to make sure they learn at the same time? But everyone was learning so differently and at different paces. Mm-hmm. It was, by the time you would get your hands around grouping them, most of these guys had either finished or they had lagged behind or the license wasn't being used. And it was very difficult to kind of clump them together. Right. So there's a lot of really important lessons learned from the experience.
Yeah, very interesting. And there are two topics that I still want to touch on. One is the comment you made about Kubernetes and whether or not we're not running Kubernetes, should we be learning about it? And I'll refer back to Sasha's keynote where he talked about that accelerating pace of change. So should we be having people learn about things that are not necessarily being used in our enterprise?
You know, I just had a conversation with somebody in the hallway about this after our last panel thing. And you know, the issue is they found is that half the time when they kind of activate people to train, they train for LinkedIn, not for themselves, not for the company that's paying for the training, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's like K8s, you know, Kubernetes is the hot thing, Istio is the hot thing. I'm going to go out and become this, you know, knowing about Kubernetes and Istio, right? The reality is, like, we don't use Kubernetes, right? So someday, maybe, right? So, you know, it's kind of the idea of challenging people, to give them the space, but challenging them in the context of their current work, mm-hmm. which actually makes it a better way to drive responsibility and to drive enthusiasm. Like, you know, I have no doubt that your method of, pointing to Sean here, the method of giving the licenses and then giving you the SLA that if you don't do these things, you're going to take it away, mm-hmm. it's probably... You know, the time constraint is a good one, but probably the fear that, like, oh, I'm going to get found out is probably another one, right? The social pressure of, like, ooh, I'm going to go on a list, right? I'm going to have somebody who didn't do something. So, like, that's not so good. I don't mean, you know, no one wants to be thought of as unreliable or as, you know, flaky in any way, right? So, but I think by assigning tasks in terms of what we need, you know, to build, I think, and maybe part of that is, okay, we've got some people that are really excited about Kubernetes. Well, mm-hmm. let's carve off a little exploratory project to be like, what's the state of the art, right? Give us the ins and outs. And how could it possibly help us in the future? Mm-hmm. We'll time box it, go do that. You can learn something about it so you can scratch that itch. But fundamentally trying to drive these programs towards, you know, we have to accomplish Project X. What are the skills Absolutely. That we need to do that? Well, instead of hiring a bunch of consultants, why don't we try to figure out, and maybe consultants are the answer, but, you know, how do we carve out some time in this process to say, okay, we're going to, you know, give people the time and the resources to learn something, and then they'll bring it back to the organization and kind of become the mentors in the organization. So trying to attach it to what the organization needs to do probably gets people more excited and more committed than being like, you know, one should learn about Google Cloud.
Absolutely.
And it's, you're like,
learning.
I'm looking at all, like, where do I start? What do I do? Am I making it's the blank slate problem, right? Like, you know, the blinking cursor in the Word doc, like, what do I do now, right?
And we actually learned from that too, where we had to create learning paths for each, like architects have a different path than a practitioner has a different path than a developer because of that feedback where they said, hey, that's really great, but yeah, we're getting anxiety because there's so much stuff and we know we got to do it, but we don't know where to start.
But you know, I understand what you're saying, like, hey, I want to learn Kubernetes, but we don't use Kubernetes here. Mm-hmm. But if we don't train somebody about Kubernetes, we may never use Kubernetes here, right? So it's a little bit of a vicious cycle. And, you know, I love the term innovation hours. Right? Yeah. Innovation hours can have so many different flavors, almost like era budgets, like you get an innovation budget, right? Mm-hmm. That says, you know, you have X number of hours that... And again, innovation happens in a lot of different ways. It could be hackathons, it could be simulations, it could be classes, it could be quiet training hours, kind of that silent disco approach. But there is a point where, as a manager, you have to make a decision whether, and I'll use your Kubernetes example, you know, do we train, you know, X number of people in Kubernetes, or do we train two people who are then required to come back and say, here's what I learned. Here's what I think it could help us. Mm-hmm. Should we take this to the next step, right? Okay. Should we go any further than that? Now, those two people may leave because, you know, they're now putting Kubernetes on their resume and on their LinkedIn and out the door they go. And there's always risk. That was always the risk, by the way. Right. Organizations have always been very reluctant to invest in training because I'm going to train you and you're going to pick up that training and go somewhere else.
Well, you've heard that expression, mm-hmm. right, where the two guys are two people are talking and
the CFO and the
CFO and the CEO. And he says, well, what if I pay for this training and the people leave? And the other person says, well, what if you don't pay for the training and they all stay?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Who is it that says, if you think hiring a qualified candidate is hard, wait until you hire one that's not. Right, or is expensive. Yeah. Hiring a qualified candidate is expensive. Wait until you hire one that's not. They're exponentially more expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, in today's talent market, I think that's a really risk. Years ago, again, dating myself, but years ago I worked for an organization where the CIO had you sign a piece of paper that if they put you through certain programs, you couldn't leave within 2 years or they tried to make you pay it back. And by the way, that was more common than you think. You're nodding your head, Sean, but it was more common than you think where they would invest a certain amount of training and you would actually be held accountable.
I've still seen that happen in degree programs. Like, we'll put you through, you know, Knight's MBA or whatever, your master's or whatever. And they do it as like a tuition deferment thing. Mm-hmm. So it's basically like, look, you sign up for it, and then we're going to pay so much of your bill off, you know, each time. And then if you don't, you're on the hook. It basically do as a loan. You go to school, we'll give you a loan. right? And then if and it will take so much, you know, and then if you every month you're here, we take so much off of this loan
that we
gave you. It's complicated, but you know, and I think, but that's kind of the point of there's a difference between general education, which I think often gets people get mistaken for.
Yes.
It's like, oh, my option for learning on the job is go take a night school course in, you know, in accounting or something like that, or I'm gonna do some, you know, Udemy kind of online things on like nights and weekends. I think people miss the fact that there is these kind of more project-based, different ways to think about becoming a learning organization that aren't traditional, you know, college curriculum or, you know, night school.
Right. We talked about this just in the panel, right, where the person raised their hand. They said, well, how would we bake that into our process? Mm-hmm. And the recommendation was, well, just add some hours to the sprint. Like you said, if I want to play with Istio or with Kubernetes, will then add some time into the sprint to play with. If I have to use that technology, well, then you have to learn how to use it. So add more time to that sprint, which is a normal.
There's another kind of interesting trick that I've seen that comes out of the lean world. People are familiar with the 5S idea that's like, you know, clean your workstation and these kinds of things. So I've seen like people do like 5S days, like once a month maybe, or you know, once every couple of weeks, once a sprint, right? And the idea is everybody gets together in the morning or agrees by email ahead of time. Here's all of a list of things. And often it's like fixing the build, you know, reorganizing the documentation, literally cleaning out my laptop or something like that. Like everyone has these kind of ideas of like stuff that's been bugging us that it's like cleaning the friction out spring cleaning,
like
right.
Yeah.
And so I've seen that the 5S kind of idea, the 5S day, which feels like you can explain it better to the bosses. Like, look, we're taking a day out of every sprint for everybody. We just block that time out to clean stuff up, to fix up the stuff that's been bothering us. It's good for morale. Mm-hmm. It's good for, you know, friction. We're kind of cleaning up some process, technical, cultural debt that doesn't require, you know, kind of a whole nother big thing to do. But then I've seen people then put training into that, right? Or the research topics, right? Like, oh, well, I'm going to go research the latest in the cloud native ecosystem. And everyone goes, oh, that's a good idea, right? And that becomes their 5S day project. And at the end of the day, they write like a, you know, like a 4 or 5 paragraph, you know, or a couple page email about what they learned.
Right.
While somebody else was cleaning out the old build.
Yeah,
cleaning out the old
build
builds or refactoring some test automation or, you know, fixing the coffee machine. I don't know, you know. The 5S.
That reminds me of the architect days where you have so many Visio diagrams on your desktop that after so long and you've been with the company for so long, you just create a folder that says new desktop and then click all of them and drop them there and just wait for the desktop to fill up again.
Old stuff.
Right.
I've done that.
So this has been a really fantastic conversation. If anybody has any final thoughts, I think if not, I'll let Jane, I'm sure Jane has some final thoughts on the importance of upskilling.
Yeah, so, you know, last year when we launched this project with the support of then Electric Cloud and CloudBees, you know, it was a passion project, right? It still is. But it was a curiosity about what skills, right? So we tell you need to upskill. What skills?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know? And so really proud of the fact that this past year we had great response to the initial survey. We're working with Evelyn Orlick, who is a former long-tenured Forrester analyst, now DevOps Institute's chief research analyst. And the results were really, really impressive. And I encourage everybody to go and download the report from 2019. I think you'll find that the data is really, really interesting, whether you're CIO, whether you're a practitioner, or anywhere in between the two. And on Monday, August 19th, we're going to do it again, right? So we're going to open the survey again for the 2020 report so that we can do a comparison year over year and use 2019 as a benchmark. We're going to leave the survey open for a long time. So this last year we did 8 weeks. This year we're opening it on August 19th. We're closing it on December 20th.
Oh, wow.
So we've decided that we really want, our goal is between 4,000 and 5,000 respondents. We had about 1,600 last year, so that was a great. We had worldwide reach, so we had good samples from all over the world. But this is a service that we are very, very excited to provide to the community. We have amazing support from some pretty impressive organizations that are helping us be able to do this. So please fill out the survey. It takes, this year's survey, I did it this morning as just as a pilot, and it took me about 18 minutes to do. So let's cut it down from last year's 30 minutes. So
did you get all the answers right?
I don't know if I got all the answers right, but the questions are really great questions. And we're also looking at being able to slice and dice the data in a lot of different ways, diversity issues, regional issues, things like that. So I want to thank everybody, for their support, but I want to thank you in advance, if you're listening, to please go ahead and just take a few minutes, encourage your colleagues to do it. It's something that hopefully will benefit you as a human, and it will also hopefully benefit enterprises all around the world.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, and we'll see you next time DevOps Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks. Perfect. Thank you.
Like what you've heard today? Don't miss out on our next episode. Subscribe to DevOps Radio on iTunes or visit our website at cloudbees.com. For more updates on DevOps Radio and industry buzz, follow CloudBees on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.